मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Hi and welcome to episode 80 of Attention Please with Arnabri. We are recording on the 12th of April, India time, and I'm Vikram Mohan. I'm very, very excited about today's episode because it has nothing to do with, you know what? I'm not going to use the C word, and we'll try to keep this episode 100% free of that which shall not be named. Also, we are taking this time out to redo our podcast pages at talkingstuff.net. to make it easier to listen and subscribe to our podcasts. So the new page is still in beta. So we would really appreciate it if you head over to talkingstuff.net/app. That's for Attention Plus Podcast. And you can also check out the pages for Binge On and WhatsApp Geeks. And do let me know what works and what doesn't. Ideally, it should make it easier to subscribe to the podcast using any podcast player of your choice and even to listen to it online. And with that, let me welcome your host, Arnab. Hey, Arnab.
Hello.
Arnab,
hello, everyone.
I'm so glad you picked this topic to talk about today. So tell our listeners what it is and why you happened to pick this one.
Yeah, so I've been meaning to do... okay, so before we start, you know, we've been doing this three episodes on COVID-19, and I thought that this is time for a break. I don't think I have anything radically new to say this week, other than the fact that I just found out that the Communist-controlled Bank of China brought 1% of HDFC, taking advantage of its fall in its share values. So he just brought 1% equity in one of India's flagship banks.
Yep.
So that should tell you something I'll let you form your own opinions. Today, we will not talk about COVID-19. I guess we'll still have a lot of time to talk about it, given that we just had in Los Angeles the stay at home, which is basically lockdown, extended to May 15th, which is 5 weeks away from now. And 5 weeks, right? No, almost 5 weeks. Kind of lost count of time, actually. And so there'll be time enough to talk more about COVID-19 as it develops, about Bernie Sanders stopping his campaign, and many other things. Today, I just didn't take a different track. And I want to talk a bit about the art of writing. This is a question that I often get, and I've discussed some of these in an isolated way. I thought I would put all of this together in one show and try to talk about how I perceive writing and what I believe are some of the tips for writing effectively. So the focus will be, of course, on fiction, because I really want to be remembered as somebody who wrote fiction rather than nonfiction, though I'm well aware that my nonfiction is much more popular than my fiction. But that's something that I aspire to, that someday my fiction will be more read than my nonfiction. But I think there's much more in terms of craft to writing fiction. Of course, there is something, and I'll talk about writing nonfiction also. So without further ado, as they say, I just want, because there's a lot of stuff to cover, let's first get to the first thing that I like to tell people. What should you write about? There are a lot of books about how to write and, you know, the style of writing and everything, and we'll talk about some of those things. But I think a bigger question is, what should you write about? And for me, the answer is very simple. Write that which you want to read. That which you want to read, but you can't find. That is what you should write. If you haven't been able to answer that question, that what it is that you want to read and you can't find, then I don't think you're ready to write yet. So it's very important that you answer this question honestly and not be guided about what you think others want to read. And I've been very clear in my mind as to what kind of books I don't want to write. Because those are invariably the books that I don't like to read. And I understand that just because I don't like to read them, it's not that other people don't like to read them, but there are books that people read. And if you remember, we had a conversation with Jay Arjun on this, is that why are some books considered literary and why are some books considered commercial? I would say commercial, or, you know, children of a lesser god. And for me, I have a strong aversion to anything which is considered literary unless it is entertaining. For me, entertainment is important. I need to be entertained by the book. And some people don't feel that entertainment has to be a part of the book, or they define entertainment as, you know, reading about a kind of life that they don't have, or that opens them up to being empathetic about other people, or they want to read about people who are marginalized. They want books that basically confirm their biases. So their books are inherently political in nature. It's not so much entertainment. So there are a lot of books that are written like this. Those books, you know, they, for me, when I read these books, I don't read those books because I can't finish them, unfortunately. Because accidentally, if I do manage to pick up one of these books. So these are books which, and again, I'm not knocking those who like this, because the thing about books, and this is very important, is that ultimately every book will find, I mean, a successful book really is one that has found its audience. There is really nothing, and my opinion has changed over the years. There's nothing really known as a good book or a bad book, you know, whether if you want to consider Chetan Bhagat, or you want to consider some of the Missed India, Kissed Russia, I'm in Love with You, and also Your Sister. These are all, like, you know, books. But ultimately, we can smile and scoff at them, but we're free to do that. But ultimately, all books are essentially trying to find their audience. And a successful book and a good book is one that has found one. And a bad book is just one that couldn't. So that, for me, that's the fundamental definition for good or bad. So in order for you to write a good book, you need to first ensure that there's at least an audience of one, that is you. Because remember, you'll definitely be reading the book you'll write many times. So it's very important that you actually like your own book. And I know people who actually write books without believing in the books themselves. In a way, I'm writing this cybersecurity book right now. It's in a way kind of like that, because it's not that I enjoy writing that book. It's not that I wake up thinking, oh my goodness, I'm going to write a chapter on cybersecurity risk management. I'm so excited for this. No, it doesn't happen like that. But I'm writing this because I have some other motive. This is not fiction writing. I'm writing this to establish my credentials in the medical device cybersecurity world. It's not that I'm going to take this book and read it in the hospital when I have COVID. That's not the reason why I'm writing this book. So, but the other books that I write, they are like that. They are books which I want to read. And I feel excited writing about them. I feel excited when I'm writing them. For me, it's important that books have a sense of motion, both in terms of, and they have to move, both in terms of the story and in terms of affecting the reader. Books that meander endlessly, books that talk about a place in time, I'm not particularly interested in reading those kinds of books or writing those kinds of books. So for me, that's why I go for genre fiction, horror, humor, in case of Yatrik, pathos, because there's a story. There's a strong story. And unless there's a strong story, and unless that story, there has to be two things. Firstly, the story has to be very strong for me in order to like it. And second is, it has to affect the reader in some sort of way. Whether it makes him laugh, whether it makes him, again, you can't make somebody jump out of their seats when you're writing or reading a book. That almost invariably never happens because of the medium of a book. It's not like a movie. But it should leave the person with a sense of unease. So with mine, that was the intent, to leave the reader with a sense of unease at the end. For Yatrik, it was to leave the reader sad, and both sad as well as happy in a way. It's bittersweet. I love bittersweet endings. with Sultan of Delhi, you haven't seen the ending, so I'm going to leave that for you to find out when I finally finished writing the book. But there's a lot of criticism about the book that it ends abruptly, because it didn't end. That's the problem with it. It didn't end. It's just almost like the middle of the book that Sultan of Delhi ended. So you haven't seen it close out. And in terms of Mahabharata murders, it's not only the solving of the mystery, which I think is secondary. It is more the insight that it leaves you. An insight that I'm pretty sure many of you didn't have as to who the real villain in Mahabharata is. An interpretation. So it's really an interpretation of the Mahabharata that I want to leave the reader with. So it's very important, these two things. Firstly, is that something needs to move. I don't like endless pages of exposition. And I don't like a book that finishes and you say, well, okay, so what now? So if these two things happen, I personally don't like that book. So for me, in order to like a book, both things have to be there. And I find very few books actually make it, which are able to take both the boxes. Now, before we get into the details of writing fiction, let's just take a little detour for short form nonfiction writing, like the kind of articles that I write for Times of India, or some of my blog posts that I used to write at one point of time. And I still write them not on my blog so much, but in terms of Facebook posts. I write them because it's just much more easy. People don't go to a website anymore. They just essentially stay within Facebook and Twitter. They don't go and click any outbound links. And that's exactly the way Facebook has always wanted it to be. So they've got what they wanted. So for short form writing, the most important thing is always go with a single thought. Some of the bad short form writing I see is just there's somebody's trying to put in two or three short posts worth into one post. And that's terrible when you write. So here's a small rule of thumb. Once you go about 700 words, you may have a second thought. But if you're below 700 words, you cannot do more than one thought. And there might be some exceptions, but in general, this is a good rule of thumb to follow. So you should decide, here's the point that I'm trying to make. For those of you who in the consultancy world and do PowerPoint presentations a lot, this is exactly true for PowerPoint presentations also. So bad PowerPoint presentations don't have a central thesis. They're just an assemblage of slides. Looked like the slides have been taken from other people, which each all sometimes is. And there is no single story behind it. And that's a bad PowerPoint presentation. Every PowerPoint presentation, you should be able to summarize what you're going to say in two lines. If you don't have that, then you're basically using your PowerPoint presentation as a PPT representation of a Word document. You've essentially lost the essence of a presentation. You're essentially using your slides to store information, which is the worst place to store information. So it's very similar. The essential principle is very similar to writing any short kind of, I won't say story, but any kind of short, even writing Facebook status updates is a work of art nowadays. So how do you do that? So let's just keep a single thought. Okay. Make it as brief as possible. Use words very, very carefully. Don't repeat yourself. People have very, very short attention spans. So if you end up repeating yourself, your thought has to be simple and single. But what supports your thought has to be many. So you need essentially seven slides in your 700 words. So every word and everything that you need to do has to support that. One of the best ways of doing things is always to have your short piece kind of circle around. So, and if those of you who read me will see that I use this many, many times, this structure where I make an initial point or I say something and then I go on. And the last line basically goes back to the first sentence. Somehow make some kind of callback to the opening. And that is a very simple way of tying everything together with a bow. Otherwise, it's again like a bad PowerPoint slide with just a number of sentences, one after another. So people think that writing short things is easy. It's very easy, right? You have 700 words, but it's very, very difficult to write. The shorter it is, 200 words, even difficult, more difficult. You have to make every word count. Every word count at that. It's like a 2020 game. Okay, you cannot have dot balls. When you're writing 80,000 word book or 100,000 word book, it's like a test match. You can have a number of normally it's not good. Normally your editor should take those out, but you're allowed to have some overs when you're not scoring. You're allowed to have some pages where, okay, maybe those pages could have been done away with. Or maybe you didn't need to say this in 10 pages. You could have made it in 4. And that's in every book. But you're not allowed that luxury when you're writing short pieces. Okay. The next point is, again, going back to fiction. This is something which works always for me. I always start with the end. I don't think that most people, most creative writing people will tell you to do this. But at least for me, it works. Because for me, at least for me, when I read, the ending is what I leave with. So if you screw the ending, trust me, especially people get pissed off when you screw the ending. It's not that when I write books, everybody thinks that the ending is amazing. But at least I should feel that the ending is amazing. Because when somebody spent like 300, 400 pages and comes and finishes badly, it doesn't matter how successful you were before that. That is the bad impression is what they will leave you. That is what they'll leave the book with. It's like, you know, you're eating something from the fridge and the last bite you take, that is the rotten part. So it's very important that you leave on a high note. And for me, that's why I always write the end. It's not that I write the chapter, but I always start off with, hey, here's what I want to finish with. So for the mind, and I'm not saying, and again, for those of you, have you read Mine, Vikram?
No. I've not read Mine or Sultan of Delhi. Those are the two ones I'm not.
Okay. Out of curiosity, why not those two ones? I mean,
what
those two?
I don't read horror, so okay. Mine's out. Sultan of Delhi, I would rather wait for both of them to come out and then do it. But honestly, Sultan of Delhi is not the... I hardly read fiction, but... this sounds interesting, so I would rather wait for both of them so that I don't have to wait and, you know, see where the story goes.
So for Mine, again, for those of you who do read horror, and the Mine, that it's the ending. So the ending that the epilogue is really what it was the first thing that came to my mind. And I worked backwards and created everything else based on that. That was the effect that I wanted. Very, very difficult to talk about it without telling you what it is. But those of you who read it, and for many people who love the Mine, it's always all about the ending.
Yeah, you do want to discuss it though, I mean, yeah, we can give a spoiler alert and ask them to forward a certain...
That's fine. I mean, again, it's for Yatrik. Again, it's a different kind of thing. But again, for those of you who have read Yatrik, it's the last story. So Yatrik is, so Anushtup, which is the name of the character, if you remember, is really a four-line, it's a four-line poem structure. That's what Anushtup is. And that's why there are three stories, and you don't see the fourth till the end. So that's the one that rhymes it, really. That's why that basically ties it together, the fourth story, which you have read the Yatrik, right, Vikram?
Yep, I have.
Yes. So again, the surprise, or I started with the fourth story. That is really what I started with. And then I made the three stories, I went back. If you read Yatrik, you'll see that the three things in his life that he sees, each of them establishes a mistaken view of the world, which then leads to the next story. So they follow. So each of these stories, one, they're not independent stories. These stories are inherently linked by his mistaken understanding of the previous story. And in order to establish that chain, I had to work backwards. It's very difficult. It might not be evident, but if you write a story forward, it's very difficult to do this. You have to write the story backwards in order to get this. So that's why I always prefer writing backwards. A book that I absolutely have written backwards is Sultan of Delhi 2. So Sultan of Delhi 2, again, the last sequence of Sultan of Delhi 2 was the first thing I ever thought of. And everything follows back from that.
So okay, just wanted to ask you something. So in your mind, you think of Sultan of Delhi as two separate books and not as one overarching story spanning both the books?
It's absolutely one story. The only the reason why there are two books is because in India, I cannot commercially sell a 500, 600 page book. That was the reason.
So, because when you were, let's say, due to commercial considerations, when you had to break it up into two books, did you have to think about, I'm assuming you would have had to think about how the first book would end and kind of like how our producers think about interval point, kaise rehna, and it's essentially a very extended interval point.
Yes. So I had to establish that, of course, that the book has to finish at a, it just can't be, and then he went out and stopped. It's not like there is the Kantisha ending, for those of you who have seen some of his movies, which basically end when he runs out of film. Okay, he runs out of film, he thinks that's it. It's not worth it for me to open another can of film, so this just ended here. So of course you cannot end a book like that. So for me, the reveal of at the end of Sultan of Delhi 1 is a big reveal. What you find out at the end of Sultan of Delhi 1, and that reveal was considered enough to end that book. And it ends with the character Arjun Bhatia he comes to a specific point where he splits the business between the brothers based on what happens at the end. And that's a big thing. It's not just, it's like a season one ends and season two starts from there. The Sultan of Delhi part two starts decades later. This is like Sultan of Delhi 1 ends in the 90s. Sultan of Delhi first sequence is 2016. So, of course, the world has moved and everything has moved. So, there is no intermediate, there's no nothing in the middle. So, the whole story is really the life of this one person, Arjun Bhatia. But it's all been set up. The first book is really the setup for the second book. Again, ideally, it should have been one big book, but I'm not a professional writer. If I had waited to write a 600-page book, I would have perhaps also myself never been able to write a 600, 700-page book all in one go. Because you have to edit it, you have to go back, you have to ensure that it's consistent, and it's just easier from a program. You know, if you're writing software programs, you would know that in writing one huge function, that's one of the reasons why it's split up also. It's not just the publishing. I mean, that's the main thing in India. In the kind of commercial space that I operate in, nobody is going to print a 600-page book straight up. Nobody's going to buy a 600-page book. Unless my name is George R. R. Martin or Stephen King or something, nobody will buy a Desi author's 700-page book. But that's what it will be when it comes out, if you break both of them together. So again, the Sultan of Delhi is a classical old world novel, which is like huge with a lot of big emotions. Most of my books, none of my other books are like that. They're mostly like single shot, very small time frame books, which don't span years. So they're easier to write in many ways. And Mahabharata Murders, again, is pretty much a simple mystery, an Agatha Christie kind of mystery. And again, the ending of it was, the mystery is as much in the serial killings that are taking place in modern day Calcutta as is the mystery is something in Mahabharata. So there's the two mysteries going on side by side. One you read and one you realize at the end what the mystery was.
Can I ask you something here about the Mahabharata Murders though?
Sure.
It also looked like in some places, I don't know whether it was... since I'm not aware of this... process itself, who decides when a chapter ends and a new chapter starts? Is that you or is that you in consultation with the editor?
No, in India, editors don't do anything.
Okay.
India editors are basically, of course, okay. So,
I'm sorry if I derailed you. I mean, the specific question I had.
In India, in general, there are some exceptions, but editors don't get into that level of detail in India. So you're pretty much left to your own devices.
Especially Mahabharata murders. I mean, it was. If you are, you know, while reading it, if you're kind of imagining it, first of all, it's in my mind, it was kind of like a Sin City kind of noirish kind of a thing, especially yes. because of the lead character. I mean, I could sense that, you know, even the chapters are kind of end as if it's more of a screenplay or like a miniseries where I can see that, okay, this end is faded, this scene is fading out, and then there's a next scene which starts off in the next chapter. Of course, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, absolutely. So here's the thing. So again, that's inevitable given that I grew up watching so many movies and watching. It's inevitable that my writing reflects an episodic. But if you read, let's say some of the work by James Patterson, for instance, you know, he writes like that. So over here in the US, some of the more modern, you know, pulp fiction, paperback writers, they write in exactly this style. Now, with Mahabharata Murders, since you brought up Sin City, yes, the whole intent was, and we're going to come to writing styles. So each of my books, they try to be slightly different in writing styles because I myself feel bored by one writing style for too long. So Mahabharata Murders is written as noir fiction. It is written in the noir style. You have the character, you have the main character, Ruxana, who's very much a, you know, a classic noir detective, flawed, hard-boiled, you know, very highly cynical. You know, all the tropes are there. Again, I don't think that India has Indian fiction has a lot of noir, so you know, it's a little sanctimonious to call it noir, but yes, that is there. The noir thing. Think Chinatown, you know, that is there. But if you remember, the chapter headings are all the names of Pandavas.
Yep.
Yes. So that was a very natural thing that lended to. You know, you have one guy who's killing people based on their resemblance to Pandavas. So obviously, the chapter heads have to be the Pandavas. And if you just look at the chapter heads, you know, the last one is Yudhishthir, right? So you get where it's going. So it was very natural and very easy to do the chapter headings. For Mahabharata Murders, I don't have chapter headings. I just have like chapters. That's it. And they're small chapters which kind of shift again, kind of cinematically from one scene to another. The next thing that I want to talk about was opening. How do you open a book? For me, the opening has to be spectacular. And this is more commercial than anything else. I think one of the things that Agatha Christie was once critiqued on was that it takes you so long to get to a murder. And Agatha Christie wrote in a time when it was, I think fiction was different. But in this day and age, it's very, very important, especially the kind of books that I write, is that you should open in a way that immediately catches the reader's eyes. And why is that? Because whether it be in Amazon or whether it be, you know, standing in a bookstore flipping through the pages, you're going to read the first one or two pages. And the first one or two pages establishes the tone. Again, this is not true for literary fiction. For literary fiction, this is absolutely not true. Essentially, if you open any great classic book, nothing will happen in the first 50 pages. And they're not supposed to. But for the kind of audience that I write for and the kind of audience that I personally am, it has to open in a way that catches your attention. And yes, this is like a TV series, any episode, which pretty much if you look at any of the successful TV series, it always opens and there's always something which happens in the first 5 minutes. Next thing is, create if you read any book on how to write books, you'll find that there are chapters on this, which is creating a conflict. You have to create a conflict that matters. Okay. So the classic example is if your entire book is about I lost my keys, then that's not a particularly interesting book, no matter what you write. Now, if the keys are the keys to the nuclear submarine, yes, it's an interesting book at that point of time. So this conflict has to be well-defined and something that the readers care for. In the mind, the conflict is Summer Bose is trying to find his daughter who mysteriously vanished years ago. That is the conflict. As we get into the mind, the conflict intensifies. It's not so much then finding his daughter. There is another thing that comes along with it, that he has to survive the mine and the traps that they're inside there. So again, this is a classic Greek. This is not anything innovative. This is the way the Greeks used to write their drama. It was a three-act way. So, you know, you first establish the conflict. In the second act, you intensify the conflict. And in the third act, you resolve the conflict. So this works. You know, it's worked for thousands of years. And so a good book, again, in the context of what we're talking about, you have to establish a good conflict, which is very, very evident. So for Yatrik, the conflict is, am I dead? That's an interesting conflict, I would say. For Sultan of Delhi, it's not immediately obvious what the conflict is. So it's a little different. It's not immediately, I mean, yeah, this is a guy, because Sultan of Delhi is a little different from all the other books. Because remember, I'm writing a 600-page book. Sultan of Delhi is the hero's journey. It's sorry, Arjun Bhatia is the hero. This is the similar to, I mean, you've definitely read a hero's journey trope, whether it be Frodo, whether it be Harry Potter. These are all hero's journeys. Whether it be Luke Skywalker, these are all hero journeys. So they all begin with the hero. When if you look at the Star Wars thing, you know, the first time you see Luke Skywalker in Star Wars part four now, you see him in that desert, right? You see the desert and the sun rising. In the scene where he dies in the penultimate movie, the last scene was that dunes again with the sun rising again. And in the last thing, Rey goes and buries the lightsaber in the same place. So you see, that's the hero's journey. These are not accidental. So when you learn how these things work, you can go and look at other things and say, yeah, the same pattern is followed here. If you see Lord of the Rings, Frodo begins at he ends at the same place. And then, of course, he goes away to the Undying Lands. And when Sam comes back, he's back at the same place. So there is this whole circle. There is this hero's journey goes and hero's journey completes. Same thing with Harry Potter. Only difference, Game of Thrones, as I said, because Game of Thrones very explicitly wants to subvert the conventions of the genre. And that's why people didn't like it at the end, because it ended up subverting way too many things. It was just not comforting. Okay, these guys have, you know, Bran did nothing. Or he was like basically sitting, and then at the end he comes and saves the world and he becomes the king. Because this is the way the real world actually works, of course. But this is not a satisfying ending. This is not the way because we're attuned to the hero's journey. We are attuned to that way of thinking. So Sultan of Delhi is that hero's journey. Rather than the intensification of the conflict, because of the 600-page expanse of it, because I just couldn't intensify the conflict and let you look, I mean, say, okay, wait, we will resolve the conflict after I get around to writing it. So the conflict, there are mini conflicts which rise and then resolve itself. Another conflict comes, rises, in the emergency another comes and resolves itself. So there are a lot of mini conflicts. But the main thing is the hero's journey. Arjun Bhatia comes from Lahore, and where it will end, you'll see that. And no, it doesn't end in Lahore, in case you're thinking that it's going to come around. No. But the next thing is, write some rules of your world. You know, you are allowed to define the rules of your world. If you think that your world has dragons and white walkers, establish that early. So in the first book, for instance, George Martin establishes that the first beginning of the first book has white walkers attacking. That's the opening. So he establishes the one fantastic element of his world straight up. And the first book ends with the dragon's eggs hatching. and the dragon's coming out. So he establishes the other fantastic part of his world in the end of the first book, which again, since he's going to be writing 8 books, it's pretty much early. So write some of the rules of the world. You can write whatever rules of the world that you have, but establish them early and be consistent with it. One of the things that make you lose readers is when readers find out that you suddenly slipped in certain rules at the very end because you wanted to get to a certain conclusion. And the best example of that is Harry Potter, Deathly Hallows, and the Elder Wand. See, those were very fundamental concepts which J.K. Rowling, if she was actually writing to a plan, should have established way early. But she didn't. I think that these things were just done to basically finish the story. So suddenly at the very end, all these really, really world-changing concepts suddenly come in the last book.
I think I'm one of the few who has not seen the movies or read the books. But similarly, I mean, even in the Rise of Skywalker, Jedis could never bring people back from the dead. And that's suddenly a new power which apparently people have.
Yeah, so exactly. So now you have Jedis bringing people back from the dead. So we've never seen this. We have never seen people do some of the things that Rey does in that movie. And we've seen like Yoda, we've seen like all the great Jedis. Nobody could do all of these things. Suddenly she can do these things. Because of course the director has changed, the writer has changed. I mean, I think the classic example of when you don't establish the rules early in the world is in Star Wars itself, when Princess Leia and Luke Skywalker kiss in the first
right. No, but then again, they didn't know, right? Even they didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. If you write something and you know, somebody always told somebody who was my agent at that point of time told me that you should always plan ahead for success. So when you write something, you should never paint yourself into a story writing corner that no, there's no way I can, even if this is very successful, there's absolutely no freaking way I can extend this. You should never do that. So this, you know, there was no reason for Leia to kiss Skywalker, right? There was no reason to establish a triangle between those.
Right.
And especially, but they did it because they were not even thinking of anything long-term. So this is juvenile writing. And it's always cringeworthy when you see it later on because of the direction they took the story later. So again, they established a certain rule in Star Wars that this is a triangle. And they quickly, very quickly walked back and made one of them the sister. So this is, again, bad writing. And it happens in movies because, of course, movies are they're not done by a single person. They're done through committee. But when you're writing a book, you have to be very careful that you don't do this within 50 pages. And I one of my biggest criticisms of Harry Potter, which I love, is that the last book absolutely loses it. As a writer, I have to like say no. I mean, I love J.K. Rowling. I love Harry Potter. I hate the movies. I love the books. But the last book was just, and I read somewhere that J.K. Rowling was under intense pressure to finish the book. She was actually not being able to finish the book, her publishers, because, you know, advance orders had gone out. I mean, this was like a massive event when the last book came out. And she was actually struggling to finish the book. And I understand that. I mean, J.K. Rowling knows way more about structure than I do. And I can see that this is something which would have eaten J.K. Rowling away, that she had to get these things at the very end. She knows this much better than I do. I mean, she's done everything perfectly till book 6. And then suddenly this happens in book 7. So it's not that she doesn't know. Otherwise, she'd have made the mistake before. It was just that there was no other way to, you know, make deadlines. This is like, anybody who's ever written code knows exactly what is going on in her mind at that point of time. Okay, so the next thing that we want to talk about was characters. The thing about characters, you know, the cliche is we want to have multidimensional characters and not unidimensional characters. So how do you create multidimensional characters? And I can do a like 1 hour or even more about how to write a multidimensional character. But here's a very simple rule. You know, take a piece of paper and write down 3 independent things that define your main characters. You don't have to do it for all the sidey characters. But for any character who you want your readers to feel anything for, define at least three things which are independent, more or less independent of each other, that character has. So for Chuha, for instance, in Sultan of Delhi, three things. He's very foul-mouthed, he's extremely greedy, and the third thing is he enjoys violence. So once you establish these three things, you want to make sure that pretty much every action of his supports either one or more of these character traits. And you have nothing that doesn't... Now, you can obviously have something which is surprising, something that someone does that goes against their character, because, you know, we as human beings, we also do that, that we do something which is absolutely out of character. But you should make sure that these things don't happen too many times. And the story itself sets the context for why they do this. Why does this person who was, and that event that triggers an off-character behavior should be sufficiently huge. And in Sultan of Delhi 2, unfortunately, I cannot reveal it. There is one such event where one person who we show to be somebody who absolutely does not care about human beings is almost pathogenically detached from everybody. That person just breaks down because of something that happens. And that's surprising because it brings out a part of him that has not been established. And that thing is something which he himself is not aware of. And that's perfectly fine. But that shouldn't be happening to everyone and for no good reason. Okay. So that's, again, when you write, when you read a book and you find that, you know, there's some, you know, these characters are going, you know that this person who's written this book hasn't thought these three things through. So mine, again, I know Vikram, these are the two books you haven't read, but...
Never mind.
Summer Bose, for instance, the main character, he's self-absorbed, he's moral, he has a sense of morality, but he also lacks a sense of empathy. And these three things are actually what lead him to what happens to him at the end. So these character traits, if you look at each of those five characters, they have three things that about them that you can write down. And these three things matter. They're not just there for the dressing on the salad. They are actually the salad. They're actually what drives each of their choices. So if you have, for instance, if you establish this troika of character traits, and then there's no hard and fast rule, it has to be three, it can be four, it can be two, whatever it is. But as a writer, you are kind of bound to make sure that just because your story has to move from point A to point B, you can't suddenly make the character behave in a strange, bizarre way just so that it satisfies, you know, it's just satisfying. And again, I think that this was one of the problems with Game of Thrones at the end, which is why many people felt pissed off, because many of the characters, they felt behaved in a bizarre way at the end, which they didn't associate with. For instance, many people were disappointed the way Dany behaved. Now, I didn't think so. I felt that that was the way that she was going to behave. I think that was established, but it could be argued for some of the other characters that they sometimes behaved a little strangely, because I think also they were trying to finish it a little bit more quickly. And I think that when Martin is very conscious of these things, immensely conscious of these things. So, you know, he writes character driven and he makes absolutely sure that everybody is in character. I think this is where the story kind of got away from him. It was being written by D&D and it was not being written by him. So, of course, they're not as great writers as you know, a Martin is or a King is. They, you know, when you write a book which is like 800, 900 pages and you write a series of 800, 900 pages, you know, you have to be damn good at this or you will just not be able to finish. The last thing you want to talk about is dialogues. You know, this is something which in my initial books I struggled with a lot. And I still do. Because firstly, it is very difficult to have authentic dialogues between Indian people in English. Okay. So you cannot, the two Indian guys will not suddenly say mother to each other. They will not. They'll say behenchod. They will not say mother, right? So you cannot use, and the term mother in terms of behenchod, they have very different connotations. Okay, you can use it in different ways.
I would be beeping out these, of course.
Of course, you can beep them out. But is there an actual limit? Because I've seen podcasts where they say fuck and all these things.
Actually, yeah, there's just, like I said, it's a guideline. We can take a chance, but I would rather not.
So the thing is that there are, you cannot use the same kind of colloquialism that translations don't happen, and there's distinctive styles of speaking. That's why there was no other way but to write a lot of the dialogues in Sultan of Delhi in Hindi. I'm well aware of that. And if you translate it at the bottom, it looks like Google Translate, right? It shouldn't even bother with that. So it's very, very difficult to write characters, you know, Indian mafia type guys talking in English. They just don't. So dialogue is very difficult to do unless you are writing about people in the language that they would be talking in. Given that, and given that there's no real good solution to that, one of the worst things that people do, and I've done it myself in mine, is that ensure that exposition isn't done through dialogue. Okay. Sometimes what happens is authors feel that rather than saying something, rather than writing something, we should show it through dialogue. Now, that's a good idea. But what then happens is, rather than narrating it, we make somebody else narrate it. So the classic example is in the beginning of Gunda, when everybody comes out and says, Mera naam hai Bulla, rakhta hu main khulla. And everybody, that is the example of bad dialogues, because he's coming out for no good reason, rhyme or reason, and essentially explaining who he is to nobody in particular. Now, of course, in Gunda, all of this works perfectly, but I'm not critiquing Gunda in any way. But, you know, if every book you read, you had people like this coming out and talking about themselves, it would be really ridiculous, because that never really happens. Another example of that is, in, for those of you who watch Bengali movies, is Satyajit Ray's Shaka Proshaka, which is possibly which he was sick at that point of time, and I think his son directed it. It is one of his weakest movies. And and I say this as a great Ray fan, there is this scene in which the patriarch is telling his son a story about his son. Okay, so this is a classic example of dialogue being used in exposition. I mean, why would you tell me my story? Or do you remember that time you did this? You're basically trying to establish something about that character. Like, that is terrible dialogue, right? Okay, and again, this, since we're on Gunda, it's wo kote wali yaad hai, that point. Of course, wo kote wali usko yaad hai. The thing is, watch Gunda and appreciate it, but realize that you should never write dialogues like that. And that's pretty much not the way you should write dialogues. But a lot of people do. I forgot the names of some book that I was reading recently, which was, and again, the reason why I've forgotten the name is because it left me so cold. It was some New York Times bestseller, blah, blah, some thriller. And it was, I mean, the dialogues had all of this very expository, ham-handed dialogues. I mean, nobody in their right mind will ever talk like that to themselves. So, you know, even two people are talking, they never talk like that. They can only talk like that. Okay, let's say two people are meeting. Or do you remember the time we did this then? And you can see from the context that the reason for that is something else. It's not to establish. If you want to establish something which has happened, write it as a narrative. Don't put it into anybody else's words.
Oh God, Dan Brown. That's what comes.
Yeah, Dan Brown is an example. Dan Brown is an example of terrible writing. Okay, Dan Brown writes, and as he's obviously, you know, in terms of writing, Dan Brown's funda, the things he says, is an interesting thing. Some of them people say are also not correct, but at least when he says it, it sounds nice. But of course, in terms of Dan Brown writes the same novel again and again and again. If you look at his few of his novels, you see they're this exact same plot. So, and it is, Dan Brown's is extremely expository, very clunky dialogue. So dialogues have to be the first thing about dialogue that I seem to work is make dialogues brief. When we talk, you know, somebody doesn't keep on just talking unless this is me doing a podcast for an hour. So at any point of time, you have one guy making a huge speech. Think about it. Does the guy actually need? I mean, there might be some great dialogue. There might be in Julius Caesar, you might have a great speech, and that's okay. You know, whether you want, what have you, you're bedding Caesar and everything, that's fine. But normally we don't speak like that. Normally we don't make speeches. Second is, you have to avoid the urge to make a dialogue be like something that a guy does not say usually. So this is where the character comes in with the dialogue. So if you have a very refined guy who's very refined, you normally won't make the person speak an expletive unless there is a good reason why. That is the intent, that you want to show that this otherwise urbane and refined guy is either not urbane and refined, or that the situation is such that he is using a form of language that he is not usually not associated with. This is like Rahul Dravid giving it back on the field. So the fact that this person is talking in a way different from the way that he usually talks is something which shows the significance of the event that triggered it. But this cannot be just be lazy writing. And another thing which, again, which works, especially in books like Sultan of Delhi, is to have a few characters who have a very distinctive style of speaking. And because it enables people to associate with that character. And this is something which actually Hindi movies in the 80s and 90s used to do very well. They would have Shakti Kapoor say one word, which he would consistently say, like, "Au." And again, you think what is going on with that? Why is saying "Summari me kummari kabadi kele kabadi" or "Pappu chalaya chappu" or these different things? But in terms of writing, what they do is they establish a connection between that and the character. So that character, again, this is Hindi movies. This is obviously, these people are extreme characters. They're not people who you normally see on the streets, and that's okay when you're writing escapist fiction. But you have these certain, very, very unique things that somebody says, and that establishes very strongly the character. That's why, you say crime master go aake nikal ke gotiya khelta. So that is something which people remember. That is why they remember the name Crime Master Gogo. Most people who have seen that movie will possibly forget the names of Salman Khan and Amir Khan. They'll forget Amar and Prem, but they will, because they're nondescript names, right? But they'll remember Crime Master Gogo and they'll remember that line. And that makes the connection. And that was why all the villains, some of the bigger villains used to have these iconic lines. Those iconic lines established the character and made that person memorable. Because remember, the villain in 80s, 90s movies, he doesn't have a lot of footage. He doesn't get that amount of footage as, say, Amitabh Bachchan or Rajesh Khanna or Jitendra is getting. But at the end, the conflict has to be established as something between equals. So how do you establish this? On one hand, you have this guy with 5 songs. And a lot of exposition and Gajar Ka Halwa and Amma and Behen and everybody. On the other guy, you have this guy who's doing shitty things. How do you establish any kind of equivalence between them in terms of drama? Well, you do it by this kind of means. You do it by the quote-unquote dialogue. And that's why dialogue is so important. And in order for you to write compelling characters as well as understand Hindi movies in the 80s and 90s, you have to understand the nature of dialogue. So you have to understand why Kader Khan wrote dialogues and why Agnipath, when you still hear it, you feel this is very unique. You listen to any other more realistic sounding dialogue in today's movies, you will not remember any of that. You will remember Dinanath Chauhan. You will remember those lines. Because those are written in a way which carefully establishes a character. It was so important for Amitabh Bachchan in those days to have these dialogues. These were the callbacks that people used to make to the character and to the movies. And this is precisely the thing which has gone out in the Hindi movies of today. That is why I don't enjoy them anymore. Because that way of narration, it has been replaced by a kind of derivative narrative structure from Hollywood. It's neither original like Hollywood, in this case, be as original as Hollywood. It's neither that, it is still unoriginal. It was always unoriginal. It's not that they were very innovative, because Agnipath, of course, if you've seen it, you'll see it is scene by scene copies from Scarface. So it's not as if it was original, but the dialogue, the narration style was very different from Scarface. It is uniquely Indian, and you can understand that. And if you listen to some of the Quentin Tarantino, Quentin Tarantino, look, I'm not original myself. I copy from different places. All my scenes are from this movie or that movie. But then why is Quentin Tarantino considered a great director? You know, in terms of originality, maybe he's not great. That might be very well be true. But the fact is, when he assembles these things from different places, he gives them a unique narrative style. And it's not a coincidence that Quentin Tarantino is the king of dialogue. I mean, you remember Pulp Fiction, not for the story, but for the dialogues, you know how he writes them. So the dialogue is an extremely important part of how the characters come out and how you end up remembering them. Even for my books, the fact that people still want to know is Chuha in Sultan of Delhi 2 is because of all my characters, Chuha has the most distinctive dialogue style, which is persistently maintained. And the answer to it is yes, he is in Sultan of Delhi 2 and has a big role in Sultan of Delhi 2. So with that, I want to end today's podcast. I hope all of you enjoyed this very non-COVID, at the time of COVID episode. And if you have any more questions and if you want to follow me to follow up with of any of these points discussed, you know, please write in. I'll be more than happy to take up an extension of this in a future episode.
Absolutely. I think this is one where, like you said, whenever you do a Q&A, we've had like one or two odd questions asking about writing, but it's good to have all of it in one podcast, which you can bookmark. Well, like I said, I believe that's our podcast for today. And before we leave, just wanted to also let you know that we have the latest WhatsApp Geeks and Binge On. They were out yesterday on Saturdays as usual. And in Binge On, we looked at, we had Indian children's movies this time. From movies for adults last time around, the pendulum swung the other way and it's Indian children's movies. And do check them out. And again, do check out the new revamped podcast page at talkingstuff.net/app and let us know if it works on your browser, on your phone, and what do you generally think of it. So that's pretty much it for this week. And until next time, take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.